debt. It keeps you tossing and turning at night. You can't get away from it. But the truth is, the system is designed to trap you in debt. Insanely high interest credit cards and loans make it nearly impossible to pay off your debt. There's a new way out of the debt trap, Pivotal Debt Solutions. Pivotal Debt Solutions isn't like the old school debt relief companies that string your debt out for years. They have aggressive strategies that can end your debt faster and easier than you thought possible. Pivotal Debt Solutions can cut or even eliminate interest. Find programs to write off your balances so you owe less. Stop those threatening phone calls, and without bankruptcy and without a loan. Bottom line, they find every solution possible to end your debt permanently. Before you do anything, contact Pivotal Debt Solutions first. Talk to them for free. Find out how fast they can help you get out of debt. Visit zapmydebt.com. That's zapmydebt.com. Zapmydebt.com.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. I've got a new book out, The Hidden History of American Healthcare, Why Sickness Bankrupts You and Makes Others Insanely Rich. And I wrote it essentially as a how-to manual for people who want to advocate for single-payer healthcare, and as a what's up for pretty much everybody else. In other words, here's the history of how we got here. I'm just going to take this hour and go through step by step all the different pieces of this. I'm starting with why is healthcare not a right in the United States? And then in the second block, going to how did the healthcare companies get so rich and powerful? And how do they maintain that power? To number three, the third part of the hour, how Medicare Advantage can kill Medicare for all. And then in the fourth part of the hour, how Canada got health care and how we can too. So why is health care not a right in the United States? The United Nations negotiated this agreement that pretty much every country in the world except the United States signed, the United Nations Convention on Human Rights, that says health care is a right. And every other developed country in the world except the United States acknowledges that healthcare is a right and not a privilege. And that's a really important distinction, because when something is defined or recognized by a government as a right, that means that if people don't have access to it, the government has an obligation to provide it. For example, education. We have decided in the United States that education is a right. Everyone has a right to a decent education. And that's why if your school is providing your kids, you or your kids, with a substandard education, you have the basis actually for a lawsuit, because you have a right to good education. In every other country, every other developed country in the world, healthcare is a right. And different governments have figured out different ways to deliver this to everybody. They basically fall into three buckets, but not the United States. We have not defined this as a right. Those three buckets, by the way, are the American system, which is mostly, you know, privatized and for-profit health insurance, the socialized medicine system, which is basically the United Kingdom's National Health Service and the VA hospitals in the United States, and the third is single-payer health care, which is what we have in the United States with Medicare, what we would have if we had Medicare for all, and what other countries have with their single-payer systems. So why is it that we never said in the United States health care is a right? Turns out this goes back to the 1880s. In 1884, Germany got their first single-payer healthcare system. Otto von Bismarck, this is even before the German Republic. This is when Germany was an empire. And the head of the German Empire, Otto von Bismarck, pushed through a single-payer healthcare system because he said it would keep the populace and the army healthy at the lowest expense to the public purse. In other words, it's the best way to do it. And he was right. That same decade, a guy named Friedrich Ludwig Hoffmann left Germany at the age of 17 with $5 in his pocket and came to the United States as an immigrant. He was a, what's the word, savant. He was a mathematical savant. This guy with numbers was, he could do magic with numbers. And he ended up having a job, getting a job with a Prudential Life Insurance Company, which at the time was the largest insurance company in the United States. And he was running numbers for them to figure out how much to charge people for their life insurance policies. And he's the guy, Frederick Hoffman, he's the guy who figured out that there's an association between smoking cigarettes and getting lung cancer, between being exposed to asbestos and getting mesothelioma, the disease that killed my father, and between working in cotton mills and getting fibrosis of the lungs, and also between eating a diet high in processed foods and getting a variety of types of cancer. In fact, his book on diet and cancer is still in print in 2021, even though he died in 1946. So anyhow, he directed his numerical work toward the so-called race problem, because, you know, Prudential at that time and other life insurance companies were trying to figure out how much to charge for their policies. Originally, they just didn't want to cover black people at all. But then, you know, as a market developed, as some black prosperity was emerging in parts of the United States, the insurance companies were like, okay, what do we charge? And so Hoffman ran the numbers. And sure enough, black people were dying at higher rates than white people, and they were getting sick at higher rates than white people. Now, you and I today in 2021 know that that all has to do with something called systemic racism. But that wasn't even a phrase back in the 1890s. And so Frederick Hoffman wrote this book based on his math, based on his research, titled Race Traits and Tendencies of the American Negro. He published this in 1896, the same year Plessy versus Ferguson turned America legally and officially into an apartheid nation with, separate but equal. And in his book, Race Traits, Frederick Hoffman, pointed out that blacks were dying and getting sick, you know, at higher numbers than whites, but then made a couple of logical leaps that he believed the evidence, the numeric evidence, supported, but now we know historically is just nonsense. The first was that this was because the reason why black people were dying at higher rates and getting sick at higher rates was because they were genetically inferior to white people. In fact, he went so far as to say that during slavery, black people were healthy and happy. His phrase. But post-slavery, without the white person to protect them, the black race, his phrase, began to essentially disintegrate. So, which led him to his second hypothesis, which was in his book, Race Traits in 1896, which was that if white people who control the politics and most of the economy of the United States simply deny health care to black people, the black race, again his phrase, would die out in two or three generations. And that would, quote, solve the race problem in America. Frederick Hoffman took this theory, pitched it to Congress, gave lectures all across the United States to state legislatures, met with governors, to physicians groups. He was beloved by those establishments. He, by the way, he was the co-founder of the American Lung Association. I mean, the guy was no slouch. He was powerful. He was famous. And people took him seriously. Woodrow Wilson, and this is why in 1912, when Teddy Roosevelt proposed a single-payer health care system to cover everybody with as part of his Square Deal plan when he was running for president for re-election, this was why that got shot down. Because white people, including the medical establishment, but white people by and large said, particularly the white racists in the South, said, wait a minute, if you cover everybody with health insurance, you're going to be covering black people too, and we can't have that. So that ended that discussion in 1912. It's also why they came after Franklin Roosevelt in 1936 when he proposed a single-payer system. It's why they came after Harry Truman in 1947 when he proposed a single-payer health care system. But black people, we can't do that. Black people will get that health care. This is why they came after John Kennedy in 1961 when he proposed a single-payer health care system. And it's why when Lyndon Johnson and Robert Ball were writing the Medicare law in 1965, the Southern racist conservative senators came to them and said, you need to build into this thing a bar high enough that poor black people in the South, and 60% of black people live in the South right now. It was even a higher proportion back then in the 1960s. So the poor black people in the South won't be able to jump over that bar and show up in our all-white hospitals. So they took Medicare Part B, which is the part that pays for hospitalization, and said, we're only going to pay for 80% of the hospitalization. There'll be a 20% gap, which is the gap that you fill in with your Medigap policy now. That gap was to prevent black people from presenting themselves in hospitals unless it was just an absolute screaming life-ending emergency. So from the beginning through the 1960s, the reason why the United States never acknowledged health care as a right rather than a privilege was because of Hoffman's theories and white racism. I mean, they were just like intertwined. And American racism, I don't know how else to say it. And that prevailed right up until the 1980s, that kind of thinking and that kind of opposition to any kind of health care program that might help black people as well, particularly poor black people, as well as white people. It's why, to this day, 12 former slave states have refused to expand Medicaid, from Texas to Florida. It all goes back to Frederick Hoffman. Which takes us to stage two, which is, you know, why the healthcare companies, or, you know, why it is that we have not been able, since the 1960s or the 70s or the 80s, really it's since the 1980s, why we have not been able to overcome that opposition, even as racism in the United States has in some ways softened. You wouldn't know it to look at the Trump rallies, but it actually in some ways has, institutionally anyway. I want to read a chapter out of the book. This is titled, Rick Scott Killed Charlene Dill. When I was 5 and 6 years old, my dad had two jobs, selling Rexair vacuum cleaners and World Book Encyclopedias door to door. We used to visit with my younger brothers and I called the cheese store every weekend in Lansing, Michigan, where we pick up powdered milk, giant blocks of processed American cheese, and a 20-pound bag of macaroni. I still hate powdered milk and love mac and cheese, which is why Charlene Dill's story hit me so hard. In 2014, she was living pretty much the life my dad had. She was working several part-time jobs, house cleaning and babysitting, and had just added a side gig selling vacuum cleaners. And like my dad back then, she was just barely getting by while parenting three young children. As her best friend, Kathleen Voss Woolrich, wrote at the time and later told me on the phone, quote, she paid her property taxes and took care of her little trailer, which she owned, and got all three of her kids to school and daycare. She was a very responsible person, end quote. My dad's heart condition didn't develop until he was in his 60s, and by then he'd been 40 years at a good union job and had excellent health insurance, even through his retirement. Charlene wasn't so lucky. As Woolrich recounted, quote, after feeling pain in her chest, Charlene, quote, went to the emergency room in 2012 and was told she had heart issues and needed monitoring and medication. But the Florida Republican Party and Governor Rick Scott had turned down $51 billion federal dollars for Obamacare's 2009 Medicaid expansion, so she had to work extra to pay for the meds, and the ER was her doctor's office, end quote. On March 21st, she was going to get together with Woolrich and her daughter, who'd essentially grown up with Charlene's kids. But first she had to earn a few more dollars to pay for her heart medication, which she'd been cutting back on because of its cost. The Affordable Care Act would have paid for Charlene's doctor visits and medications, but the billionaire Koch brothers in particular were incensed by that prospect. They put up millions to fund advertising and PR campaigns, first to stop and then to destroy what Americans had started calling Obamacare. Rick Scott, who was heavily supported by the Koch brothers, they sent 40 paid staffers to Florida to help with his last gubernatorial campaign, followed their libertarian line by taking money from rich people to pay for the health care of working poor people was a bad idea. After all, it might hurt their incentive to work a second or third job like Charlene Dill did. When Obamacare was rolled out, the National Federation of Independent Businesses, the NFIB, went on the attack pressing a lawsuit that went all the way to the Supreme Court, National Federation of Independent Business v. Sebelius. The NFIB likes to present itself as a representative of small businesses, but its CEO makes nearly $1 million a year. And as Renee Feltz wrote for The Guardian, past tax records reveal most of the NFIB's funding comes from Freedom Partners, whose nine-member board includes eight current or former key figures at Koch Industries and other Koch entities. More than 95% of the candidates it backs are Republicans. Nonetheless, the NFIB went into court as the protector of small business rights, including the right to not have government take money from the Koch brothers and their peers to pay for working people's health care. Joined by 26 Republican-led states, with politicians taking money from various Koch-funded enterprises and a few right-wing individuals, the NFIB claimed that requiring every state to expand Medicaid to cover their working poor was an unconstitutional form of coercion. The Supreme Court agreed, which is what gave Rick Scott the ability to not expand Medicaid, and is why Charlene Dill was out selling vacuum cleaners, rainbow vacuum cleaners, her third job that day, and dropped dead of a heart attack. So we get why we don't have health care as a right? Racism, essentially. How is it that we never got just a decent health care system in the United States? Well, obviously, prior to the 1980s, it had to do with racism. But the big thing that happened in the 1980s was in 1983, when Ronald Reagan instructed the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission to stop enforcing the antitrust laws. This was the greed is good era. This was the less government is better era. This was the deregulation era. And so we went from two dynamics got blown up. The first was, when Reagan came into office, most health insurance companies in the United States were nonprofits, and most states required that. And most states required that all their hospitals be nonprofits. I ran a little herbal tea company in Michigan from 1972, I think it was, until 1978, called the Woodley Herbal Company. And we sold herbal teas. We had a little factory and a bunch of employees, and healthcare was cheap. We provided healthcare to all our employees. And all three hospitals in Lansing were nonprofits. So what changed was that this Reagan revolution, two things. Number one, by ending the anti-monopoly enforcement, we went from hundreds of health insurance companies across the United States to about a dozen. And number two, by ending the requirements, state by state and federally, by ending the requirements that health insurance companies be nonprofits and that hospitals be nonprofits. Nonprofits, of course, their first goal is to serve their customers. They don't make a profit, whereas a for-profit, their first goal is to show a profit for their owners and stockholders. These two things just kind of combined to make this dozen or so health insurance companies that came out of the Reagan deregulation so wealthy and so powerful that anytime a politician stood up and said, gee, maybe we should take on the health insurance industry, they would just squash them like a bug. This is an industry that's making a billion dollars a month in profits. This is an industry that could buy any politician in America who is willing to be bought, and probably has. This is an industry that can carpet bomb America with television advertising, for months at a time with a single day's leftover profits. And so when Joe Lieberman, for example, was the deciding vote on whether we would have a public option, which would give everybody in America the option of buying into Medicare, which the health insurance companies, of course, correctly saw as the camel's nose under the edge of the tent, right? The beginning of the end for them. They gave Joe Lieberman over $1 million through his career. And he said no to the public option. He's the guy who killed it. And he was a Democrat. Well, actually, he was an independent then, as I'm forgetting which politician it was who said it. But, Paul Begala actually said, it says, Joe Lieberman, I, Connecticut, I is for independent. He said, I should stand for insurance. Of course, he was from Connecticut, which is where some of the biggest insurance companies in the country are based. So it shouldn't surprise us, except that under the laws in the 70s, in the early 70s, it would have been illegal. But the U.S. Supreme Court said, money is speech, And if the health insurance company industry wants to buy politicians, that is simply them exercising as corporate persons their right to free speech, their First Amendment right to free speech. And that's why we haven't seen an expansion of Medicaid in the states. It's why we haven't seen Medicare for All. It's why we haven't seen anything like it. In the last part of this hour, I'll get into how we could have Medicare for All in the United States, how other countries have done it. The essence of the issue here, if we're going to have Medicare for All, right, this is one of the goals. One of the best ways to get a national health care system is to take an existing system like we have, an existing single-payer system, Medicare. Medicare runs on a between 2 and 3% overhead, depending on whether or not you include government buildings and things in that overhead. So at the most, a 3% overhead. Health insurance companies are capped at a 20% overhead by Obamacare. They used to run 30, 35% overhead in some cases. Of course, that 20% overhead means it's costing a whole lot more. So the thing that the health insurance company, and I frankly have to give some credit to George W. Bush, because I think that they all saw this coming back in 2003 when they, quote, reformed Medicare. What they saw coming was the possibility that Medicare could become our national health care system, and they wanted to add a private component to it, lickety-split, as fast as they could, so that if Medicare became our national health care system, there was still a giant space there for private health insurance companies to make a fortune. So in 2003, what they did was they took Medicare Part C, which had been around for a long time, and was like, it was a little crack in Medicare that could be filled in with private health insurance under certain very rare circumstances. And they said, we're going to expand this little crack to be all-encompassing. Anybody can buy one of these health insurance, these private for-profit health insurance policies. And instead of calling them private for-profit health insurance, we're going to let the companies call them Medicare Advantage. They're not Medicare. They're not subject to the same rules of Medicare. Doctors don't have to accept them. They can refuse to pay for certain doctors. They can refuse to pay for certain hospitals. In fact, they all basically work that way. They have in-network systems and out-of-network systems. They pre-approve things. None of this happens with Medicare. Right, if you've got Medicare, you go to the doctor, nobody needs any approval, you get tests, nobody needs any approval, you go to the hospital, I had surgery, nobody had to check with anybody. But if I had had Medicare Advantage, which are actually not Medicare, these are private for-profit health insurance plans, then I would have had to jump through all those hoops, and I would have had to be sure that my doctor was actually in the program, and if the hospital had, for example, an anesthesiologist, this is one of the more common ones, who was a contractor to the hospital and therefore not part of the hospital network. And after my back surgery, I might have ended up with a $10,000 bill for anesthesiology. This commonly happens in the United States for people who are on private health insurance policies under 65 or on Medicare Advantage policies over 65. So what they did was they built out this Medicare Advantage thing as a way of building, in 2003, the Bush administration and Congress, as a way of establishing a beachhead inside Medicare, or what looked like it was inside Medicare, so that if we ever went to Medicare for All, they would already have the upper hand. And in fact, because the Medicare Advantage plans are so unregulated, when you're healthy, they offer you all kinds of goodies. Hey, free rides to the doctor. You want meals? We'll give you meals. You want $100 a month? We'll give it to you instead of you paying us. Well, you got $0 payments. I mean, we've all seen the ads right on TV with Joe Namath and other TV stars or other stars. And yeah, sure, you can get all that stuff, but wait till you get sick. They have these two policies, I don't mean like insurance policies, these two systems, essentially, that the health insurance companies use with these privatized Medicare, so-called Medicare Advantage programs. They're called cherry-picking and lemon-dropping. And cherry picking is where they offer things that are incentives to people who are healthy to get into the programs. For example, free gym membership. You know, that appeals to healthy people, so they're more likely to sign up for these Advantage programs. On the other hand, once you start getting sick, after you've been on the program for 5 or 10 years, and you're now in your mid-70s or your early 80s, and you're starting to get expensive, then they do what's called lemon dropping. And lemon dropping is where they basically make it miserable for people to the point that they give up and go away and go back to regular Medicare once they get expensive. You know, they make you jump through multiple, instead of having to jump through 2 hoops to get your surgery approved, you now have to jump through 5 hoops. I mean, there's no limit, essentially, to what they can do because it's so minimally regulated, Medicare Advantage. And they've reached now a third of Americans. I tell a story in the book about a friend of mine. I call him Sam in the book. It's not his real name, but he's a guy that back in the 70s, myself and some friends of mine in New York City used to hang out with down in Greenwich Village. And I used to do a lot of business in New York. And I used to spend a lot of time in New York in the 70s. And he was just a couple of years younger than me. And last year, while I was writing the book, in fact, I got a call from a mutual friend of ours. I hadn't heard from Sam literally since probably 1975, 76, something like that. You know, it had been 40 years or something like that. And my friend told me that Sam was having a tough time. He turned 65. He went to sign up for Medicare. He got hopelessly confused Googling it because he was just overwhelmed with all this Medicare Advantage sales pitches and everything else. And he couldn't figure out how to sign up for actual Medicare with the federal government because the federal government doesn't have the budget to pay for search engine optimization and to pump out thousands of papers and ads from think tanks and ad agencies to litter up the internet. And so he just gave up. He said, screw it. You know, I'm still healthy. I just turned 65. I'll figure this out in a couple of months. But he was having trouble peeing, as in urinating. So he went to a local doc in the box. I mean, he'd been healthy his whole life, right? In fact, he didn't even have a regular doctor. So he went to a local doc in a box, one of these emergency medical care places or urgent care centers that was run by a large hospital network. And said, I'm having trouble urinating. What's going on? They took some blood and they came back and he had a PSA that was through the roof. I mean, it was so high that not only was it a certainty that he had prostate cancer, or his prostate was just like, in some kind of raging infection, but also that it had probably broken out of the prostate and metastasized. And metastatic prostate cancer is the second leading cause of death among men in the United States. He had heart disease. So at that point, he thought, I need to do something about this. He's at this doc-in-the-box place, this urgent care center, and they said, as they were processing his, his $200-$300 payment as he was leaving, they said, we can sign you up for a Medicare Advantage plan that is provided by the company that owns this hospital, and it won't cost you a penny. It's a $0 plan. And so he was like, cool, okay, sign me up. And so he signs up for Medicare Advantage. He then starts calling around, and so now he's got insurance. So he thinks, okay, I'll go find a surgeon or I'll find a prostate expert who can tell me what's going on. He starts calling around. He finds out that the top prostate cancer people in the country were at Sloan Kettering Memorial in New York City. And so he makes an appointment there. They say, do you have insurance? He says, yeah, I've got Medicare. They're like, okay, cool. We'll see you when you get here. He shows up a month or so later. And lo and behold, his Medicare Advantage program doesn't pay for Sloan Kettering. In fact, none of the Medicare Advantage programs in New York City pay for Sloan Kettering. None of them. Because, hey, it's the highest quality, but it's also the most expensive. So then he tries to get off Medicare Advantage and discovers that once you're on Medicare Advantage, if you try to go back to regular Medicare and buy one of those Medigap policies that fills in that 20% gap that was put there by those racist Southern senators who told LBJ they wanted a bar for black people to jump over, that if you try to sign up for Medicare, regular Medicare, no problem, you can do that. At least you can do that in the fall and between October and January during that open registration period. But if you want to get a Medigap policy so you don't end up with $100,000 surgery with a $10,000 or $20,000 bill that you have to pay, if you want to get a Medigap policy, While they cannot consider pre-existing conditions when you turn 65 and you first sign up, they can consider pre-existing conditions if you're coming back from Medicare Advantage, and they can simply refuse to insure you. So he's looking at having Medicare pay for his surgery, but having basically planning on going bankrupt when the bill comes for the 20%. That's where we're at. And this was all to make sure that we, when we move to Medicare for All, or if we move to Medicare for All, there's still a place for the health insurance industry. And now about a third of people over 65 have bought the sales pitch and are on these private, for-profit Medicare Advantage plans rather than on real Medicare, thinking that they have Medicare when they don't. It's just a brand. It's just a label, Medicare Advantage. It's not real Medicare.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, how Canada got Medicare for All and how we can too. This is from The Hidden History of American Healthcare, my new book.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Reading from the book, this is from page 114. This is the solutions chapter, you know, part of the book, The Hidden History of American Healthcare. It's titled Undoing Reaganomics and Reducing Inequality Would Save Lives. At its core, healthcare is about making and keeping people healthy. We think of it in terms of doctors' offices, pharmacies, and hospitals, but it's really all about making and keeping people healthy. Given that larger frame, there are a number of government policies that have nothing to do with paying doctors' bills, but should be an important part of this conversation. Generally, people understand these peripheral issues and policies to include things like taxes that discourage the consumption of alcohol or tobacco, anti-addiction programs, incentives for people to get more exercise, for example, by bicycling to work. All these are important, and many of them move to front and center policy-wise when everyone in the country has a financial stake in the health and well-being of its citizens because everybody's paying into the national healthcare system through their taxes. But in terms of bang for the buck, there is one thing that has a greater negative impact on the health of a nation's citizens than any other single policy: economic inequality. Outside of providing full and free access to healthcare across the board, no other factor has such a broad and sustained influence on the health of a nation's people as does economic inequality. It's not about poverty. Although the United States has the worst and deepest poverty in the developed world, and poverty has real and negative consequences, inequality affects the health of nearly everybody except the very, very rich in a society. It's not about the spending. The United States accounts for about 40% of the entire world's healthcare expenditures, with only a bit more than 4% of the world's population. But we don't have the world's healthiest or most long-lived people. Far from it. Many much less wealthy countries have much better physical and mental health, even though they spend less than half per person of what the United States spends on healthcare. Inequality is about the difference in the income and/or wealth between a society's richest and poorest members. Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett have spent decades researching inequality, producing a body of work that includes three internationally best-selling books, numerous articles, and a nonprofit called the Equality Trust. Looking at a wide range of health and social problems across a society, from obesity to children's educational performance to suicide rates. Pickett and Wilson found that the best predictor of a nation's well-being wasn't the amount that the society spent on health care, education, or housing. It wasn't how rich the country was, either in aggregate or in average. It definitely wasn't how many millionaires or billionaires a country had. Instead, they found that the countries with the greatest inequality in wealth and income had the absolute worst outcomes on a whole range of social and health measures, while the countries that had greater equality fared significantly better and measured significantly better. Every single index is worse in a country with great inequality. They include, but are not limited to, infant mortality, life expectancy, depression and mental illness, height, birth weight, the rate of teenage pregnancies, imprisonment rates, obesity, social mobility, children's educational performance, social and political trust and engagement, hypertension and heart disease, and homicide and suicide. Looking at the countries of the developed world, Pickett and Wilkerson found that the more unequal a nation was, the worst its outcomes. And the United States is the most unequal country in the world, and therefore we have the worst outcomes in every single one of those categories I just named. So going through this, I'm kind of skipping through the book here, essentially, or the concepts that are in the book, The Hidden History of American Healthcare, Why Sickness Bankrupts You and Makes Others Insanely Rich. And I wanted to talk about how can we get to a single-payer healthcare system in the United States. And there's a couple strategies I outline in the book. One is, let's just buy all the health insurance companies. They're worth about $1 trillion, their market capitalization. That's the first year of Trump's tax cuts. It's an amount of money that, is not that big a deal for the federal government. Just buy them. That's one possibility. I doubt that's going to happen, but, I wanted to lay it out as an idea. But the other is how Canada got health care. Tommy Douglas was a politician from Saskatchewan who went off to be a federal politician, what we might call a member of Congress. He was a member of the Canadian Parliament for years, back in the 50s. Where he was advocating for single-payer health care without any success at the federal level. So finally, he just gave up. He said, screw this. He went back to Saskatchewan, which is, it's a fairly large province, what we would call a state. But like Vermont, it has a fairly small population. So you can really do retail politics there. When I lived in Vermont, people used to joke about how everybody in Vermont has shaken Bernie's hand at least three times because he just does retail politics constantly. He's like the Energizer Bunny. And it's probably up to 10 times now. Well, Tommy Douglas went back to Saskatchewan and did that. He did retail politics. He just traveled all over Saskatchewan and got elected premier, governor, and pushed through and passed and put into place a single-payer healthcare system. And it was so successful at giving everybody coverage at a really low cost and really working well that within a year or so, the provinces around them were, Ontario, British Columbia, they were like, whoa, this is cool, we want this. And within a decade, I believe it was less than a decade, it had spread all the way across Canada. Every Canadian province wanted to have what Saskatchewan had, and they all cloned it, although they did it in different ways. Some provinces included vision, some included mental health, some included hearing aids. Yeah, I mean, it varies from province to province, and there's different prices from province to province. And then the federal government stepped in and created a kind of backup funding system so that if somebody from Saskatchewan got sick while they were visiting Ontario, the Ontario system would provide for their care and then could bill the Saskatchewan system via the federal government. So, it's worked well and it's based in the states. We can do the same thing here in the United States. Vermont already passed single-payer health care and tried to put it into place. California, too. Both of them were stopped dead in their tracks by the fact that if a state goes single-payer, they lose access to Medicare and Medicaid payments. Because back in the 60s, Lyndon Johnson built into Medicare and Medicaid because he was concerned that the southern states would take the money and then refuse to use it to pay for black people's health. So they put into these two programs basically a provision that says if the states try to to take this money and use it other than exactly the way this law provides, they can't have the money. So what we need to be doing is contacting our legislators, our two senators and our member of Congress, and telling them in plain, straightforward, simple language, please vote for Medicare and Medicaid waivers for the states so that individual states can put into place single-payer systems. That's how you say it. And they'll all understand exactly what you're talking about. The actual, you know, pitch would involve acronyms and ERISA and all this kind of complicated stuff. But if you just say, please vote for these waivers. Now, the health insurance companies have been fighting these things tooth and nail. Congress has repeatedly proposed them. Democrats in Congress have repeatedly proposed these waivers. Bernie has been at the forefront of this, but, you know, it's right across the board. Many Democrats are supportive of this. But the Republicans and a few of the Democrats who are deeply in the pockets of the health insurance industry have been fighting them. If we do that, then overnight, California and Vermont will have single-payer health care. And you can bet your bottom dollar that within a year or three or four or five, pretty much every other state in the United States, maybe excluding the red states where they haven't even expanded Medicaid, but pretty much every other state will have single-payer health care. And the pressure will be on the politicians of every single state in the United States to do what these other states have done. So this is a very straightforward way that we can bring about health care for everybody in the United States and just join the rest of the world. Canada has better health care outcomes than the United States. Their people live longer than the United States. And the only reason is, or the largest reason, inequality is part of it, but the largest reason is that everybody in Canada has health insurance. And everybody in the United States doesn't. We have tens of millions of people who have no health insurance, and we have over 200 million Americans who have who are essentially underinsured, who would go broke if they got sick, seriously sick. So we got to fix this. And I wrote the book as kind of a how-to manual on how to do it, The Hidden History of American Healthcare, Why Sickness Bankrupts You and Makes Others Rich.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Medicare is continuously confusing to me. I'll share that with you. And I was mixing up parts A and B. So I went over to Medicare.gov because somebody earlier had called and I said I thought that part B was hospitalization. That's part A, actually. And that's, the whole Medigap thing. And in general, part A, I'm reading from Medicare's website. In general, part A covers inpatient care in a hospital, skilled nursing facility care, nursing home care, hospice care, and home health care. That's part A. Part B covers clinical research, ambulance services, durable medical equipment, mental health, inpatient, outpatient, and partial hospitalization, and limited outpatient prescription drugs. So there you go. That's, you know, right from their site. And if you want to learn how you can move from Medicare Advantage to back to regular Medicare, or vice versa, you know, as you may choose to do, there is a site. There's a website called SeniorsResourceGuide.com, and tip of the hat to Jim who sent this to me, and thank you, Jim. SeniorsResourceGuide.com, and if you go to there and then /directories/nationals/SHIP. Which I just tweeted, because that's too long for anybody to write down while I'm talking about it on the air. So just look at my most recent tweet, and it takes you right to this site. And it's titled, Find Your State's Health Insurance Assistance Program. So if you want help with Medicare that's not, you know, you're not talking to an insurance broker, you're not talking to somebody who's going to try and make some money off you, you're talking to a state employee who understands the policies and the laws in your state. They're all listed on this one website that I just tweeted out from this Seniors Resource Guide. So hopefully that's of help. Sasha in Kent, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Sasha, what's up?
Hey, we had a caller from Washington who wanted to get off of Medicare. I call it disadvantage. The one thing I understand is that she must do that during the upcoming period that starts October 15th. That's the time. And she's lucky. In Washington State, we have an insurance commissioner's office. I found them very helpful in looking at plans, and they are especially helpful on looking at the Reagan penalty on medications. and they help sort through which is the best program that covers the medications that you need.
Oh, that's interesting. So you've got actually counselors who are employees of the state of Washington who don't have a dog in the fight or whatever terrible
exactly
metaphor you want to use.
Exactly the words I was going to use. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. So how do you contact them, Sasha?
Someone gave you a phone number, and I thought, oh, I should have looked up the number. But it's Washington State Insurance Commissioner's Office.
Okay.
And then they can
That should be fairly easy to track down. That's great.
Yeah.
Thank you for that, because I shouldn't be the source. In fact, I'm going to officially stop advising people what to do or even suggesting what people should do, because I don't want the responsibility. I don't want somebody coming back on me and saying, well, I did what you said and, you know, disaster happened. But B, it's just, you know, I'm not an expert on Medicare and Medicare Advantage. I'm a reporter. I spent a year researching it. I compiled that research into a book. I present it to you for evaluation. But, you know, there are people who are experts on this, though, like the people over at SocialSecurityWorks.org. And obviously, you know, with your state insurance commissioner. And so I should just defer to them in all cases. And I will do so in the future. Sasha, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. Mark in San Francisco. Hey, Mark, thanks for watching us on Facebook. What's up?
Oh, Tom, you know, Eugene Robinson, a brilliant journalist, says that this is a Republican pandemic, and we should be calling it out as a Republican pandemic, and the Democrats should as well.
I agree. You know, they referred to the Great Depression right up until after World War II, right until the end of World War II. They referred to it as the Republican Great Depression. And then when Eisenhower became elected, it kind of fell out of favor. But we should start calling it the Republican Great Pandemic. There is a new study that was just published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. It's titled The Carbohydrate Insulin Model, a Physiological Perspective on the Obesity Pandemic. Conventional wisdom and the theory behind most dieting is that if we eat fewer calories than we burn every day, we lose weight. And if we eat more calories than we burn every day, we gain weight. It just makes sense. It's very mechanistic, but it just makes sense. It's very mechanical. But it kind of treats our body like a machine. And our body isn't actually a machine. It's a very complex organic system, living system, with all kinds of interrelated parts that interact with each other. And what they found, you know, they point out obesity affects more than 40% of American adults, placing them at higher risk for heart disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes, and certain types of cancer. And the conventional wisdom is, you know, that people are overweight because they eat too much, and eating too much is what causes them to be overweight. And to stop being overweight, what they need to do is stop eating so much. Well, what these folks are saying, what these researchers are saying based on their research, is that there's a fundamental flaw in that model. That model actually doesn't work with our bodies. That actually what has happened is that when we, back in the 80s and 90s, we went on this low-fat binge because we thought fat was causing heart disease. Turns out it wasn't fat, it was a particular type of fat, which is, you know, trans fats, which have been largely removed from our diet. We went on these zero-fat or low-fat foods, and what they did is they replaced sugar with the fat with sugar or with highly refined carbohydrates. And what those do is when you consume a lot of these high glycemic foods, these processed, rapidly digestible carbohydrates, they, quote, cause hormonal changes, the responses that fundamentally change our metabolism, driving fat storage, weight gain, and obesity. So, again, reading from the summary of this report, when we eat highly processed carbohydrates, the body increases insulin secretion and suppresses glucagon secretion. This, in turn, signals fat cells to store more calories, leaving fewer calories available to fuel muscles and other metabolically active tissues, including your brain. The brain perceives that the body isn't getting enough energy, which in turn leads to feelings of hunger. In other words, eating highly refined foods and lots of sugar and carbohydrates, basically white stuff, eating that causes our body to start storing those calories as fat and that triggers our body to say, more and more, I need more and more, this isn't enough, because it's all getting redirected into fat rather than being available to the brains and the muscles, to the brain and the muscles. So it's not that overweight people are overweight because they're eating too much. They're eating foods that are causing them to store fat and causing them to crave more of those kinds of foods. The solution, they say, is very simple. Adoption of this model has radical implications for weight management and obesity treating. Rather than urging people to eat less, which usually doesn't work, we should focus more on what we eat. Reducing, according to one of the physicians who wrote the thing, reducing consumption of rapidly digestible carbohydrates that flood the food supply during the low-fat diet era lessens the underlying drive to store body fat. As a result, people will lose weight with less hunger and less struggle. Eat your veggies, right? And, you know, everything else that's not highly refined sugars and flours. Amazing. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. It's accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/Hartman with two N's. netsuite.com/Hartman. That's netsuite.com/Hartman.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
This week, there was an interesting piece in the New York Times yesterday about how a couple of people within the Biden administration have joined this kind of international call for America not to do booster shots. And the reason that they're citing, in fact, two of them are talking about resigning their jobs in protest. The reason that they're citing is that there's not enough vaccines in the world for everybody, so Americans shouldn't get booster shots. We should instead be giving those booster shots to other countries. And I read the entire article kind of with my jaw hanging loose. I mean, because it made no mention of a kind of plan B, an alternative where everybody in the world could get vaccines. And Americans could still get boosters. I mean, they were not arguing that protection doesn't decline with time. They were simply arguing kind of the moral position of how dare we, you know, overconsume vaccines when other people can't get any. But there is another way around this. And Lori Wallach, our old buddy who is the executive director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, tradewatch.org is the website. Is back with us. Lori, welcome back to the program. What is first of all, for people who haven't heard this conversation before, because people tune in and tune out all the time on radio programs and TV programs, just recap for us real quickly what a TRIPS waiver is and what the situation is.
So the basic situation is that the World Health Organization says we need someplace between 14 and 15 billion more doses of vaccine to be able to vaccinate the world, which is the only way to end the pandemic. Right now, vaccination rates in poor and middle-income countries are about 2.5%. So we get outcomes like the Delta variant, which came from India, where there's no vaccination to speak of, and the COVID's raging. Any place the virus is raging, we could get new, more dangerous, horrible variants that basically keep us in an endless pandemic. So this is not something that is a technological problem or even a financial problem. We know how to do it, and the money's there. Right now, there are intellectual property barriers, including those enforced by the World Trade Organization. So those are monopolies. The big pharmaceutical companies control if, when, how much vaccine is made. And a year ago, October 2nd, 2020, South Africa and India proposed to waive temporarily those monopolies so that we could have vaccines being made by qualified companies that exist all around the world. So we could actually get enough vaccines made.
Third world countries, in other words, do have the ability to make vaccines. They make their own measles vaccines. They make their own polio vaccine. I mean, this is not a capability that they lack. It's not like we need to send boatloads of vaccine manufactured in the United States to these countries. They can make them themselves. What's blocking them is basically that these big companies have patented these vaccines and are saying, you can't have it. Is that right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So what you call the TRIPS waiver, that's shorthand for the WTO's agreement on trade-related intellectual property, TRIPS, is waiving those rules that right now make every country in the world give these monopoly control rights to those handful of companies that are being greedy and won't basically even allow other companies to pay them to make more doses. So right now we're just coming up on the United Nations Global Assembly, the summit of all the world's leaders. It's a year after that idea got hatched, and there's no progress. A handful of countries are blocking it. The Biden administration did the right thing in May. They reversed the Trump administration's opposition to letting more vaccines be made. But since then, the Biden administration really hasn't stepped up to make it happen. And Germany and just literally one or two other countries are blocking 150 countries that want this waiver. Plus, the Biden administration has not used the authority it has. It has statutory authority to, like, make Moderna, share those recipes, because the U.S. government paid for the research. We're one of the holders of some of that patent. And then the third thing is they haven't really stepped up and put up the money to do what you just said, which is to have global production. You know, we're not going to fix this by sharing the existing slices of pie. We need to build more pie factories.
Right.
And we have the capacity to do it. We're just not there. And so this big UN meeting with all the world leaders, this is the moment where President Biden just has to deliver.
This is next week, right?
The summit is next week. Not only will Germany, the blocker, be there, but also all the world's leaders will be there. And President Biden has called for a special COVID summit. But, Tom, yesterday, the list of things they're trying to achieve at that global summit started to circulate around Washington. And it's really embarrassing. It's just like a conference to talk about donating existing doses.
Okay.
It's like, hello, we know that's not going to work. We've seen for a year that it's not working. 2% of population in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America have these vaccines. We need to make more. It is a damn crisis. And it's in our interest directly. It's not just the ethically, morally right thing to do. It is in our interest. And yet, this very modest, tweaky proposal seems to be what the Biden administration has in mind, which is to say we all need to raise the heat, raise the pressure to get Joe Biden to follow through what he said. He said the right thing. Tommy did the right thing. In May, he was totally brave.
Yeah.
He said, in the face of pharma hysteria, we're putting saving lives first. And now we have to help him deliver.
Yeah. And so how do we do that, Lori?
So I would love everyone to join in on a petition that's going to the White House. That is at tradewatch.org. That's www.tradewatch.org. When you land on that website, up in the left-hand corner, it basically has get involved in global vaccinations. Click on that. You go right to where there are actions. It's very easy to do, and you can pass it on to friends. That's number one. Number two, a lot of members of Congress are very exercised about the fact that the administration has not made a global COVID plan. So if you have any kind of relationship with your House member or your senator, please weigh in with them. The White House really cares what these members of Congress think, and as they're starting to pile on the White House saying, hey, where's the plan? That will help your petition and your members of Congress. It can make a real difference. That's at tradewatch.org.
Right. So, Lori, we've talked before, you and I, about how Angela Merkel has been the kind of the roadblock here, at least the largest roadblock to this. And let's be clear, these TRIPS waivers would not eliminate or even reduce the profitability, the companies that are currently making these vaccines, the third world countries that, you know, they would continue essentially to license the vaccine technology from them. They just wouldn't pay them the high prices, but they would pay them a much lower price. So it would expand the profitability of these companies. They would be getting money for doing absolutely nothing. So it's not like, you know, we're trying to play, you know, Bolshevik revolution here. You know, just to be clear, do I have that right, first of all, before I go on to my question?
You have it spot on.
Okay. So the question, I've been reading, particularly in the Financial Times, they're following the German elections very carefully, very closely, because Angela Merkel is on her way out. And her chosen guy to be the Christian Democrats, the biggest party, or the, you know, the party that she represents and that has won four out of the last five elections, is kind of faltering. How does German domestic politics play into this, or do they not?
Well, you're right on with that question, because this is the moment. This is why President Biden stepping up now at this UN global summit when all the other heads of state will be there is so important. Because with Angela Merkel leaving, and she's been a passionate opponent to this waiver, is an opportunity. Nobody knows who the next head of Germany is going to be and what political party. The Greens, who are doing quite well, support the waiver at the WTO, support technology transfer, see the situation for what it is, which is a global crisis of humanity that we have to unite together to conquer. The socialists, who are also doing pretty well, the democratic socialists, those guys are a little split. Some of the party thinks there should be a waiver. Some of them are not for the waiver, but there's an opening there. And then, as you said, Angela Merkel's party, the Christian Democrats, they're all about big pharma and keeping the monopolies. Right. So if the German election results, as people expect, as you just said, in Merkel's party not running the show anymore, that's an enormous opening. But in order to translate that into shots in arms, we need President Biden right now, next week, when he's with all of his other heads of state buddies, to basically lay down the law, which is to say, just to be brave. It's not that he has to persuade them. They all agree. Hell, even the president of France, as far as Europe's position, is on the right side of this. It's just a question of being the brave moral leader, of getting up ahead of steam, cutting the wake so everyone else can follow, and basically getting this done right now. Because, Tom, the alternative is too horrific to even contemplate.
Right.
It's an endless cycle of new variants.
Yeah, it's more mutations, more variants, more death, more disease all around the world. Lori Wallach, TradeWatch.org. Get over there, check it out. Upper left-hand corner, click the activism button. Is that it? Get involved button?
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.